Welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. Well, as the coronavirus crisis continues to strain medical systems, hospitals could be facing extremely difficult choices of how to allocate limited medical resources like testing kits, ventilators, beds, even staff. The supply of ventilators in the U.S. in particular was already limited before the coronavirus outbreak began, and there are they are, of course, a crucial piece of equipment for the most serious cases of COVID-19. They allow patients to breathe while their body fights the virus. So hospital ethics committees have been quietly starting to draw up guidelines for what would be done in the worst-case scenarios, especially where life-saving medical resources like ventilators could become scarce. That's our topic for the rest of this half hour. Let me tell you who's with us. David Magnus is director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at Stanford University. He's also a professor of medicine and biomedical ethics and a professor of pediatrics at Stanford. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Also joining us, Dr. Jessica Zitter. She's a physician trained in both palliative and critical care medicine, also an attending physician at Highland Hospital in Oakland. Let me open up the phone lines. I think this is a question that concerns a lot of people. Folks may want to join the conversation. The number is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. And you can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Let me begin with you, David Magnus. What are some of the questions that hospitals are maybe quietly, but maybe not so quietly, discussing right now as this surge, you know, continues to rise?
Yeah, so first of all, what everybody is trying to do as best they can is plan in such a way that we can hopefully avoid having to ration ventilators or other scarce resources as much as possible. So part of the planning is trying to do everything to both expand capacity as much as possible while the public health efforts to flatten the curve are undertaken to try and hopefully keep the demand at any one time sufficiently low that the expanded resources that are being developed will be adequate to the needs. That includes changing some of what standard practices are so that it's not absolutely not going to be care as usual, but if you are willing to make some changes to the kinds of things that are normally done, it's possible to expand capacity, and everybody's hoping avoid the kind of triage situations that are clearly being seen in Italy and New York.
What are you referring to there when you say changing standards?
That can sometimes mean changes in staffing ratios. It can certainly mean changes in work hours for the clinicians and how they operate. It means opening up beds that wouldn't previously have been licensed to be opened and expanding capacity in that way. So there are a number of measures that are not part of the usual practice of medicine under everyday circumstances where there's a lot of regulation about exactly how things go. And by loosening some of those requirements, many of which have already taken place, it becomes possible to expand capacity.
And Dr. Zitter, what? Who first of all would make these decisions? Is it the head of the hospital? Is it individual ICU directors? I mean, how does that? What is the decision making chain exactly?
Well, I'm not actually part of the decision making chain at our hospital, but I do know that, you know, around the country we're hearing, you know, even there's many, many different kinds of health services at universities that are starting to sort of open up spaces that hadn't been previously used for anything, or even cafeterias and gyms. So, I think that most hospitals are really trying to just figure out whatever spaces might be available for extra beds for patients who might need ventilation and other types of intensive care.
And how concerning is this at this point to the people who work in the hospitals that they may, you know, may come down to some of these difficult decisions?
I mean, I think that everyone is really sort of hoping for the best and preparing for the worst. I think that this is something we've never really in any way faced in our country and certainly in modern times. And I think it's something that everyone's really, again, hunkering down and trying to figure out how to deal with a worst case scenario.
And David Magnus, I mean, you know, medical ethics is a topic that has been discussed for many, many times. It happens around issues like organ transplants, end-of-life care, you know, those kinds of things. You know, what is it about this pandemic, if anything, that is unique except for the specific questions?
So that's actually a very interesting question. Obviously, I think the sheer scale and nature of the shortages are a little bit different, but there have been other areas where there are just not enough resources to meet need and where rationing has had to be put in place. Organ transplantation, which you just mentioned, there's been different approaches to how to allocate those resources. Some are done very well. There are definitely criticisms of the system in some ways, but on the whole, there's been an effort to develop a relatively fair process as much as possible for the allocation of those organs and to try and continue to improve that. So that's an example of an area where we've been facing shortages for a long time. Another example would be the shortages in drugs. So there are periodic times when there's just not enough drugs or biologics available, and that's actually become a regular part of medical care, and sometimes that requires, again, similar kinds of considerations of rationing around those things. What's different now is, I think, the nature of the interventions, which are things like ventilators, and the sheer scale of it, that this has the potential to affect such an incredibly large number of people all at once who are not who were not previously in that sort of circumstance, unlike patients who, for example, have organ failure and are awaiting a transplant. So I think the fact that almost all Americans are confronted with the possibility that some aspects of their care may have to be rationed is something that's new to people, and especially that the life-saving therapy is, I think, part of the reason why there's so much attention. But I do want to say one other thing. Although everybody is scrambling around to do what they can to address those particular shortages for this particular crisis, there has been an enormous amount of planning by many states, by many academics, by professional organizations, including the National Academy of Medicine, and by many hospitals to prepare for things like this. We engaged in a two-year process to develop a crisis standard of care back between 2005 and 2007, and there has, in fact, been a lot of effort made to try and be ready for this, and what we're trying to do is figure out how to adjust and adapt those plans that are grounded in a set of theories and principles and how to apply them to the particular context that we're in right now.
And what are some of those principles?
There are a number of principles that are at play. They include things like proportionality, transparency, fairness, make sure that we're making decisions based on appropriate criteria like good outcomes and who's most likely to survive, so that our decisions are made to promote the most lives saved or the most life years saved, rather than based on bias like certainly one of the main concerns that a lot of people in the disability rights community have is that when it comes to rationing, decisions will be biased against people in those communities. And so worries about fairness, worries about making sure that whatever decisions are made are proportional to the resources that are available, making sure that things are transparent, that we're communicating with people about what kind of values are at play and what decisions are being made. Those are all really critical values.
And Dr. Zitter, I'm wondering if you have had, or your colleagues, conversations like this, not necessarily around COVID-19, but around any aspect of the amount of care, the amount of treatment that is available or is recommended to a patient. What are those conversations like?
Well, I mean, the thing that's so amazing about this moment is that we've had this sort of idea that there's always, for the most part, I mean, I'm not dealing with transplant patients very much as somebody who works in a public hospital. So we don't necessarily, ventilators are something that we in America have always sort of said is ultimately available to somebody who wants it. And so we have many conversations with patients who may have very poor prognosis. And sometimes the patient decides that they, or their family, that they would still want to be to maintain on a ventilator. And this happens a lot in America. And so this is the first time that many of us in the sort of practice community who haven't been thinking about sort of how to do allocation if this kind of an event happens, we haven't been planning for that or even imagining this kind of situation happening. Many of us are sort of trying to figure out, wow, how do we have these conversations about saying, oh, look, this ventilator that you've always thought was available to you is not going to be available to you. The thing I will say is that, as palliative care doctors, we are very accustomed to having conversations with people about bad news that we can't change, that their prognosis, their cancer is worsening despite treatment, et cetera. So we have these kinds of conversations about, look, we are so sorry, this is some bad news that we have to give you. And in a way, this idea of saying to somebody, we can't put you on a ventilator, is an extension of that type of interaction. Mm.
And I wonder what kind of, you know, there's always sometimes suspicions around who does have access. Early on in this pandemic, you know, there were people, you know, like Kevin Durant was getting tested and others who were fairly well known, while others were having a hard time getting the tests, the access to the tests and so on. David Magnus, what assurances can providers and officials give people in general, the public, that this is not going to be up for the, you know, the highest bidder or the person with the most connections?
Yeah, that I think is critical. And that means being very explicit about both the values that are or principles that are governing the decision-making process and be transparent about what's driving it and make that as evidence-based as possible. So one of the backbones of almost all of the plans for across the country, many other things are added to it, but one of the main things for allocation of resources in this case, if it comes to that, is to use things like something called the SOFA score, the Sequential Organ Failure Assessment, which really is a very accurate predictive tool for who's likely to pass away immediately from critical illness. So the more we use clear, objective evidence of whether that's identifying particular comorbidities or identifying sequential organ failure, the more, or if the evidence really supports it, even using age potentially as a criteria, the more we have very sound criteria that are evidence-based driving decisions that produce the most life years saved and the most lives saved, I think the more that we can say that it's a fair process. A fair process does not guarantee a fair outcome, however, because we know that those outcomes are not distributed equally in society, and so the fact that there are existing health wealth gradients in society and disparities in relation to race and ethnicity means that even if you have a fair process, it is, in fact, likely to result in outcomes that differentially impact some populations more than
others. Well, excuse me, and to what extent are those decisions based on, and this is, it's a terrible thing to even say, but the, you know, the, I don't even know how to say it in a way that's not going to sound terrible, but the, you know, the, I hate to use the word value, but the amount of years a person has or the amount of productivity, I mean, obviously a young person is going to be more likely if they're up against an older person for a scarce resource like a ventilator, somebody who has a better chance of surviving. But how are those decisions, those excruciating human subjective criteria factored in?
I think it's going to be really important that we don't allow those kinds of judgments to play a role. Deciding that somebody has more social worth than another person, even deciding that this person has so many more years of life ahead of them, though some allocation schemes use that justification, I think are prone to bias. So basing it on factors that predict outcomes of who's going to survive and live and for how many years, that can be based on good evidence. But I think that's what is going to have to drive it rather than any decisions about quality of life that somebody might have.
And I think last week, HHS, the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, issued some guidelines and really a warning on behalf of people with disabilities, people with brain injuries and that sort of thing, that as these kinds of decisions are made, Dr. Zitter, that, you know, that kind of bias should not be, or assumptions perhaps about people based on what their situation is, that those should not come into play. I mean, is that something that you think, you know, hospitals are thinking about right now?
Well, absolutely. And I think, you know, working at a place like Highland Hospital, where we have basically a clear set of principles about caring for patients, regardless of their insurance status, their disability, their housing, et cetera, certainly race, gender, et cetera, that we are really very focused on that important approach to making sure that people are not in any way penalized for those types of variables and social variables of any sort.
We're talking about medical ethics and the coronavirus pandemic, how hospitals are considering allocating medical resources during this crisis. Our guests are David Magnus, director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at Stanford University, and Dr. Jessica Zitter. She's an attending physician at Highland Hospital in Oakland. If you'd like to join us, give us a ring at 866-733-6786. Again, it's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Here's a comment from Linda, who writes, the Center for Practical Bioethics has an excellent webinar on pandemic ethical issues, which might interest your listeners. It includes a brief history of pandemics, a comparison of COVID-19 to the 1918 epidemic, flu epidemic, the Spanish flu, ethical issues for relevant constituencies, and so on. David Magnus, what are some other sort of resources like that that you could recommend to our listeners that, you know, they might find either interesting, informative, or reassuring, whatever?
Sure. The Hastings Center has a set of resources. We actually have some resources on bioethics.net, which is the website that accompanies the American Journal of Bioethics that I'm the editor-in-chief of. In addition to those resources, I think the most comprehensive information that's out there is in the several reports that have been issued going back to 2009. There are three different reports by the National Academy of Medicine, and just yesterday the National Academy of Medicine sent an updated letter to with some guidance that reiterates some of their earlier approaches and recommendations about policies in the event of a need for rationing, and they just sent that to the presidential COVID-19 task force. So that was just yesterday, and all of those things are publicly available sources to the National Academy of Medicine. Lastly, I would say if you look at the New England Journal of Medicine and the Journal of the American Medical Association, both of them have a lot of information available, including model policies that was published on Friday in JAMA and another model policy in New England Journal from March 23rd. And I believe most of that material, which normally is firewalled, is being made more freely available.
I've been hearing from friends who work in hospitals in the Bay Area that elective surgery has been postponed or canceled indefinitely while this is happening. Dr. Zitter, what is considered elective? I mean, what are some of the kind of wobbler decisions, you know, ones that you could say really aren't elective? This is really medically necessary.
I mean, I think that's a tough one. And, you know, different hospitals I'm hearing around the country are doing sort of making different sets of priorities on that. I mean, as you've been hearing, in fact, some places have been saying that, you know, abortion is not considered a priority, that it's considered elective. I think that this is really something that will be hospital by hospital, as far as I know. And I think that one of the very important things we've got to do is figure out how to extend and keep our patients safe, keep our staff safe as well as we can by trying to sort of extend the strategies in which we interact with our patients. There's a huge bounding increase in interest in telehealth, and there's a lot going on in terms of primary care, keeping patients away from the hospital, and keeping, you know, trying to serve people in different ways than we are typically used to doing.
Talking about medical ethics, if you'd like to join us, the number is 866-733-6786. And let's go to Jennifer in Pacifica. You're next.
Hi there. My question is that I am a stage 4 cancer patient, lung cancer. And I'm just wondering, because I'm actually in very good shape, if you will, for the shape I'm in. And if I were to be hospitalized and needed a ventilator, would you consider my current status, or would you just base it on my diagnosis?
Great question. Dr. Zitter?
Well, I think that it is a great question, and a lot of it just really comes down to this model that we are still working with. And I, in fact, David probably will have more helpful input on that, but the ultimate arbiters of how this rationing will work really start with the SOFA score and what is your acute situation in that particular hospitalization on that day. How likely are you considered to, by scoring system, to survive that hospitalization? And then bringing in other factors that have to do more with long-term comorbidities, heart and lung issues, and cancer. But I think that the scoring system is still being worked out. And David, if you have anything to say on that, that would probably be helpful.
The first thing to say is that at the present time, nobody is planning on rationing ventilators. that things would have to get a lot worse before we hit that point. The governor would have to declare a crisis standard of care. So the thing, first thing is just to reassure people that this is not a step that anybody is going to take lightly, and things will have to get a lot worse than they are now. Everybody is doing everything they can to avoid any of those kind of difficult trade-offs and decisions, and everybody's going to do everything they can to avoid this happening. But if it does wind up happening that we don't have enough ventilators for everybody, then, as Dr. Zitter said, we're going to have to make decisions based on, you know, depending on what your clinical presentation would be, if you got sick enough that you had to have a ventilator, how sick were you, what else is going wrong with you when that happens, as well as taking into account comorbidities and life expectancy. So if somebody has a life expectancy of less than a year, then that would be a factor. I would say that I just want to add that I'm happy to hear that you're in very good shape today, and hopefully that this won't arise for you as well.
Yeah, Jennifer, I wonder what kind of conversations are you having with your healthcare providers or your family, or has it really not, you know, has it really been more private at this point?
Private. I actually was diagnosed 2 years ago and able to still work full-time and exercise, and really I'm not symptomatic at all. It's just that I've been diagnosed with it. So I'm lucky enough at this point to be where I could walk into a hospital and nobody would know I'm sick unless I looked at my medical record. So it's really just a diagnosis. It's not a symptom at all for me.
Yeah. So. Well, let's hope it stays that way. I assume you're taking extreme precautions to avoid the virus.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. I'm not leaving the house. And if I have to, I'm wearing a mask and not going anywhere in public. That's for sure.
All right. Well, thanks for calling and stay well. Yes.
I'm really glad that Jennifer called in with that question, because I think a lot of people are starting to think about that as we start talking about the very, you know, the possibility of rationing again, which we are not doing at this point, and hopefully we will beat that need. But if we do get into that place, I think it's really important for people to have an honest assessment of their personal situation. And there's actually a tool that I would love to recommend, which you can put on KQED's website, that was put out by the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. That's a tool that allows you to sort of really take an assessment of yourself, your age, your current health status, and any symptoms that you may have that might be related to COVID, and really get an assessment of the risk of you going to the hospital, the risk of you dying from this illness, and or of going onto mechanical ventilation. And I think it can help people think through their decision-making about even deciding to go to the hospital or to take care at home.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for that. All right. Let's go back to the phones now. And Chris in San Jose, you're next. Welcome.
Hi. I was just thinking that, you know, we have resources available that are used to making tough judgmental, you know, decisions like this. And I'm wondering if, rather than putting it on the doctors to decide who gets resources and who doesn't, maybe we should bring in some of our judges who aren't doing anything and let them evaluate some of these cases and make some of those decisions, so the doctors can just focus on saving the people that, you know, that they can save.
Yeah. David Magnus?
With all respect, I think that's a terrible idea. In general, when we've had judges have to weigh in on medical decision-making, it's often challenging because they just don't know enough medicine. So I think it's appropriate to say that this is not a decision that any individual physician should be making at the bedside. We don't want to put that burden on them. But that is really not what's being proposed. For the most part, these are at a minimum, institution-wide policies that are being developed and the decisions are being made at a higher level. We hope that those are going to be in accord with regional standards, so that all the hospitals in a region or even a whole state will be doing the same things. And there's a lot of coordination and discussion that, although there's maybe a little bit of variation, for the most part, almost every hospital in the country is going to be using fairly similar standards and fairly similar approaches that are based on a lot of very good, sound work, both normative, ethical work about justice and how to apply it, as well as the medical details that are needed to inform the current crisis to make decisions that are pretty uniform and evidence-based around the country.
Chris, any follow-up question from you, or are you good?
No, I'm fine.
All right, good. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Here's another listener who writes, how do people's personal choices play into the allocation of limited resources such as ventilators? I'm in my mid-30s and have had type 1 diabetes for many years. It's my understanding that if there are a limited number of ventilators that I would likely not receive one, should I need one because of my diabetes. I've been social distancing since early February, doing everything right, as it were. I don't even do my own grocery shopping. How do people's behaviors come into play, if at all? David Magnus?
Well, I mean, these are very hard questions to answer in the abstract. I would think that somebody in their 30s, type 1 diabetes might be a comorbidity, but everything would depend on what actually happens for that patient. So if somebody is in their 30s with well-managed type 1 diabetes and the only problem they had was respiratory failure, so they only had one organ system down, in the allocation schemes that I've seen that have been promulgated around the country, that patient would actually do pretty well and be at a relatively high priority on the allocation list. The really way to think about it is the focus is trying to make sure that the ventilators are being given to the patients who are most likely to benefit. And just to amplify something that Dr. Zitter mentioned earlier, in our current status quo, when we have plenty of ventilators and we mostly and before this crisis hit, where we basically leave it for the most part up to families to make decisions about whether they want that kind of level of support, we spend an awful lot of resources at baseline putting people on ventilators who have very, very little chance of surviving. And I think the first thing, if there is rationing that has to take place, for the most part, you would hope that any rationing is really focused, and that's really the goal of all these different weighting systems, is to make sure that the people who you first don't give them to are the ones who are very unlikely to benefit from it anyway.
Yeah.
And that's really what the goal of all of these rationing schemes is.
Just about 90 seconds left, but I want to quickly, David Magnus, if you could respond. There was an article over the weekend in the Washington Post that seemed to suggest that the federal government is making decisions about which states are getting what, either in a very haphazard way or in a way that perhaps politics figures into it. That has not been confirmed, but that was the suggestion. You know, what are the ethical considerations at the level of from the White House down when it comes to this?
Yeah, you would hope that all allocation decisions, whether that's for ventilators in hospitals, allocation of resources to provide regional support from the federal government to the states that need it most, are really based on these core ethical principles. There are trade-offs among them. Generally, you're trying to produce the most good that you can, but you're also taking into account what's sometimes called a prioritarian approach, where you're looking at the places with the greatest need. So sending those resources to the places where it can do the most good and also to the places that have the greatest need should ethically be the way to do it rather than political practice as usual.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. David Magnus, director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at Stanford University, Dr. Jessica Zitter, attending physician at Highland Hospital in Oakland. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Scott.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, Ariana Prale, Blanca Torres, and Susan Britton. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our interns are Michael King and Jameson Weiss. Our executive editor is Ethan Lindsay. And our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.